My name is John Beck, and I'm the director of the Labor Education Program here, which is one of the two parts of our daily work, our daily lives, the other part being the Traditional Arts Division of the MSU Museum. Our daily work, our daily lives has actually been around campus now nearly 20 years. And this is the 15th year of our brown bag. Next year will be our 16th year of our brown bag. And because today is the last brown bag of the series for this school year. And it's co-sponsored by our friends here on campus with the Journal for the Study of Radicalism, which has been around for a number of years, which is co-edited by Ann Larrabee and Arthur Vosloos on campus. I think it was one of the first places I met Tim. Yeah, if you would just kind of, just a little bit, that'd be great. Where I first met Tim, I believe, was either at the Wayne State North American Labor History Conference or at the Radical History Conference that was done by the Journal a few years ago. Now, next week is the 125th anniversary of the Haymarket Square bombing. And that bombing, as Tim and I were just talking prior to the talk, is one of the things, when I travel worldwide, two things stand out elsewhere when they think about American labor history, American radical history. One is the execution of Joe Hill, IWW song writer and organizer. And the other is the Haymarket Square riot and the Haymarket martyrs. So this talk today is, number one, timely because of the anniversary next week, but it's also because of the one word in Tim's title, which is the word enduring. Haymarket is 125 years ago, yet many of the things that have come into place in terms of American labor iconography, the way that things are talked about, really come out of that experience, not only of Haymarket, but of the important 8-hour day strikes that ultimately led to the Haymarket riot. And the fact that that's the real rise of kind of a unitary American industrial sector in America, where we weren't necessarily only small communities, but you could actually have a labor movement that was truly nationwide. Now, Tim Messer-Cruz is with the Department of Ethnic Studies at Bowling Green State University. And he's done a number of presentations on Haymarket, which you'll see reflected in today's work. And he's here, so please help me welcome him to talk about the enduring power of the Haymarket Square bomb, uncovering the hidden history of a failed revolutionary uprising in America. Tim Messer-Cruz.
Well, thank you very much, John. Thank you all for coming out today. I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to talk about Haymarket, especially on this coming up historic weekend, 125th anniversary, but also that I've been serving as graduate dean down at Bowling Green, and it's just wonderful to get out of the office for once, so really appreciate that. I'd like to talk about Haymarket. It's difficult on some levels to talk about because it's an event that's almost burdened with its familiarity. There's been so much written about it, so much published about it, so much talked about it. It's memorialized every May. Of course, it is the beginnings of International Workers' Day. And I never really quite know where to begin with it. I don't really have a clear idea where your understanding of it might be. So I'll just run through some of the basics quickly and then talk about where my research begins. So in 1886, there was a national movement for the 8-hour day, and it actually began about 2 years before when the predecessor to the American Federation of Labor set May 1st, 1886 as a deadline, a national deadline for unions to win the 8-hour day or go on strike. So it was one of the first unified, planned national actions for a particular labor reform in American history. And as that date drew closer and closer, radicals in Chicago, we'll talk later on about their label of being anarchists, but self-proclaimed anarchists jumped on this bandwagon of the eight-hour day, and by the upcoming May Day weekend, they had begun organizing both their own supporters and others for this effort. On May 3rd, 1886, there was a large presence in front of the McCormick Reaper Works, which is one of the most modern and largest industrial operations in the city of Chicago. This led to a confrontation with police that eventually led to the death of one of the workers, one of the protesters there. And that evening, anarchist leaders resolved to protest the violence, the police violence at that strike. And they set the following night, May 4th, for a large protest rally. This is the flyer that was distributed, very famous image from this period. There were several versions of the flyer. The one that was most inflammatory said in both English and German, "Working men, arm yourselves and appear in full force." That night, some of the anarchist speakers, Samuel Fielden, Albert Parsons, August Spies, addressed a relatively modest-sized group of workers that night, modest compared to other labor rallies that they had organized in the past. About 10:45, 10:50, as the speeches were winding down, a column of police marched up the street, 162 police officers shoulder to shoulder in ranks, ordered the meeting to disperse, and at that point, someone threw a bomb into the middle of the street. It exploded very powerfully and led to a general exchange of gunfire. And in the aftermath of the bombing, one police officer died immediately on the scene. Over the next 5 weeks, six other police officers died. Some people say that a eighth police officer who died 18 months later can be attributed to the wounds that he received that night. So depending on how you calculate, either seven or eight police officers were killed that night. An unknown number of protesters were also shot and killed. At least three that are documented of the workers in the square were killed that night. In the weeks following, the police conducted a major investigative operation throughout Chicago, hauling in known radicals, hauling in the entire staff of the Arbeiter Zeitung, the leading radical newspaper in the city. Everybody from the devil's boy apprentice of the printer on up to the editor of the newspaper were hauled in at one time and arrested eventually. 16 individuals were at one time or another listed under articles of indictment by a grand jury, but these, the state's attorney, eventually whittled down the number of people indicted to eight. And all eight were well-known radical leaders in Chicago. Of course, there was a ninth member, a ninth person indicted who was never brought to trial, and that was an individual who the police and the state's attorney accused of actually throwing the bomb, Rudolf Schnaubelt, who left the city and was never seen again. Eventually, he was traced to Argentina, where he apparently lived out the rest of his days. The trial went on for about 8 weeks over the course of the summer of 1886. Of the eight men on trial, all were found guilty. Seven were sentenced to death. One was sentenced to life in prison. Over the course of the next 18 months, there were numerous appeals to the Illinois State Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and after all legal options were exhausted, the seven were still facing the gallows. Governor Oglesby of Illinois eventually commuted the sentences of three of those eight men to life in prison. Of the remaining five, the gallows were constructed in Cook County Jail, and the date, November 11th, 1887, rapidly approached. The night before the executions were to be conducted, Louis Ling, one of the condemned men, took his own life by placing a explosive charge in his mouth and smoking it like a cigar. He was the youngest of the defendants at age 22, and you can see him here on the right. He died in about 5.5 hours of his injuries. And the next morning, the remaining four anarchist leaders were executed. The three men who were sentenced to life in prison were eventually pardoned by Governor Altgeld in 1894. That's the general outline of the story. Of course, in the aftermath of this drama, all sides, participants to the drama, memorialized it in different ways. Radicals and working class leaders and union officials memorialized the executed anarchist leaders with a beautiful, graceful monument in Waldheim Cemetery, today Forest Home Cemetery in Chicago. Eventually, this would be declared a National Historic Monument by the U.S. Park Service in 1997. And more recently, there's a very interesting sculpture that was constructed on Des Plaines Avenue in Chicago near the site of where the wagon, where the speakers actually spoke, by Mary Brogan, the artist Mary Brogan, is there today. On the other side of things, police officers and those, a businessman's association in Chicago, donated funds and constructed a monument to the police officers who were killed that stood on Haymarket Square for many years. Eventually it was moved throughout Chicago, finally to end up in an interior courtyard of the police academy after it was blown up twice by the Weather Underground in the 1960s. Recently, with the construction of the new Chicago Police Headquarters, it's been brought out again into public view. Today, if you go to the Chicago Police Headquarters, it faces the parking lot, so you can see it there. And of course, in the aftermath of the Haymarket affair, the story of the Haymarket martyrs eventually became more and more part of the folklore and the ideology, especially of the Second International and the International Working Industrial Workers of the World, and through the tireless efforts of Lucy Parsons, the widow of Albert Parsons, one of the executed men in this trial. She helped publicize the story and keep it alive. She lived to the age of 88 and continued to advocate the memory of her husband into the 1930s. And as a result, partly of her efforts, and as a result, partly of some other interesting confluences of movements that I don't have time to go into, the May Day became International Workers' Day around the world. And throughout the world, the story of the Haymarket martyrs is recounted every May, although not so much in America, where we had an earlier Labor Day in September, and May Day eventually became a law day in many states of America, as the left embraced May Day as sort of a not a workers' holiday particularly, but a combination workers' and left holiday, at least in America, because we had the more, you know, business unionism September Labor Day. So that's kind of where it is. The other interesting thing about Haymarket is the amount of scholarly and popular attention that has been given to the event. The master bibliography of writings on Haymarket, as of it was published in 1995, contained over 1,500 entries for scholarly works on Haymarket. So it's a very well trod story and well documented story, which leads to the question, why would I ever want to write yet another book about Haymarket? Why does the world need 15,203 instead of 15,202? Well, I first became interested in the story as an undergraduate, actually in 1986 on the centennial of the Haymarket affair. One of my college buddies, who at that time was majoring in history, at that time I was interested in economics, and he said, let's go to Chicago. They're having this ceremony to remember what happened 100 years ago. And at that time, I really didn't know very much about the Haymarket story. And so I got in the car with him and a couple other friends, and we bombed down to Chicago. We were in Wisconsin at the time. And it was a really striking weekend. I was really struck. We went to Waldheim Cemetery where there was an observance. And just the solemnity, the emotions, the deep feelings of the crowd assembled at that cemetery really struck me. It really, really made an impression. Enough of an impression that when I got back to Wisconsin, I began majoring in history instead of economics. So in many ways, my career sort of began at that point, at least my historical career. And I eventually became a labor historian. I wrote primarily on 19th century issues of labor history, although not so much around Chicago or Haymarket. But I always taught in my classes, my labor history classes, about Haymarket. And I was teaching at the University of Toledo about 10 years ago, maybe 12 by now. And I was lecturing about Haymarket, and I mentioned that the trial went on for 8 weeks. And I also mentioned what is in almost all the historical accounts of Haymarket. This is a very typical, what you'd find in a typical college textbook that's writing about Haymarket. In this one, James Henretta and Brody and Ware's America's History, which should be good on labor history because Brody is a very well-known labor historian. They write, the anarchist sponsors of the rally, some of them not even present, were arrested and charged with criminal conspiracy, a legal doctrine so broad that no direct involvement in the bombing was required to justify a verdict of guilt. There was, in fact, no evidence linking them to the bombing. Four men were executed, one committed suicide, and so forth. Well, the textbook that I was using was very similar to this. And one of my students sheepishly raised her hand, and she said, Professor, if there was no evidence and the trial went for 8 weeks, what did they talk about? What could they possibly have talked about for 8 weeks? And this is one of those awkward moments as an instructor. We all who have ever been in front of a class, you have no answer to the question, and you have two options. You can admit that you don't know, or you can kind of misdirect the question into something else. And for some reason, I just frankly admitted, I don't know. I have no idea. But I added a little bit of a little bit more to that. I probably shouldn't have said this. I said, but I'll find out for you. So I began looking into it. I began trying to find out what did they talk about for 8 weeks in the trial. And I found out, oh, and by the way, this is very common. Indeed, on the bronze plaque on the bottom of Mary Brogan's sculpture, it says, the identity and affiliation of the person who threw the bomb have never been determined. This anonymous act had many victims. None could be tied to the bombing itself. So this is a very common statement. You find it in all the major works about Haymarket, the original one in 1887 by Dyer Lum, and then Henry David's first PhD dissertation, History of the Haymarket Affair of 35, and the most famous, many of you have probably read this one, Paul Average's Haymarket Tragedy in 1984, which won many national prizes. Okay. I'll come back to this in a second. I just want to point out one other thing. So I began researching this student's question, and I was amazed to find that there are just at that year, there just was published an internet archive of the actual transcript of the trial. How lucky could I have been? That trial transcript, there had previously had only been two copies. One was in the archives at Springfield, one was in the Chicago History Museum. And any scholar who wanted to look at them had to go to one of those two places and sit and read through it. Well, it's over 3,000 TypeScript pages long, so it's a very daunting task to do. But here it was, all digitized, all scanned, all available on the web, thanks to the Library of Congress, which contributed a major grant to get this work done. And so I had the luxury of sitting at my computer in my office, and I began reading the actual transcript of the trial. And how engrossing. I couldn't believe what I was reading. I could not believe the information that I was seeing, because not only was it dramatic, and not only did you get the real human story behind these things, I mean, the witnesses who testified, the whole Perry Mason courtroom drama was just incredible, but the information that I was reading was very much at odds with everything that I'd ever read about the Haymarket trial. And this idea that there was, quote unquote, no evidence connecting any of the Haymarket defendants to the bombing itself, it became more and more difficult to believe that as time went on, as I began reading through these 3,000 pages. One of the most interesting things for me was finding out that in this trial in 1886, there was a tremendous amount of attention given to what today we would call forensic evidence. But back in 1886, this was such a new area of investigation, there wasn't even a word for it. In fact, the first textbook on forensic investigative techniques wouldn't be published for several more years, and then it would be published in German, and there'd be no English language edition for several more years after that. I mean, even Sherlock Holmes didn't make his public debut till 1887, so it's even before that. But in this trial, there was quite a bit of physical evidence introduced into the trial. One of the most interesting things that I found was that the state introduced bombshells. Here's one that they claimed to have found in the apartment of Louis Ligg. That when they searched his apartment, they found a trunk under his bed, and inside the trunk, in an old black sock, was this unexploded bomb. And indeed, they found some other bomb-making materials. They found a false partition in the wall of his apartment where there was some other bombshells. And the interesting thing about this particular bomb is that it's made of two hemispheres held together, filled with dynamite, and held together with a particular bolt, as you can see, and a nut on the top. And this is very interesting. They found similar types of nuts and bolts in his apartment. But more interesting than that, there was, the night of the bombing, there was a bystander. Maybe he was a protester, but he was about a half block away. And when the bomb exploded, he turned his back. He made a reflex and he turned his back, and he was struck by a fragment of the bomb. And it took a surgeon to remove the fragment. It was embedded deep in his buttocks. And they removed this fragment of the bomb, and it turned out to be a nut, a square nut of the same caliber as the square nut and bolt found in Louis Ligg's apartment. So that was very interesting. I found that interesting. And I continued to investigate this whole interesting connection between the bombshells allegedly found in Ligg's apartment and other evidence found at the scene. The Chicago police asked one of the professors of medicine at the Rush Medical Institute, Walter Stanley Haynes, who was a trained chemist, to do some analysis on some of the evidence that they gathered from the scene. One of the things they asked him to do was to do a chemical analysis of the bombshells found in Ligg's apartment and compare that to a chemical analysis of some of the fragments that were tweezed out of the dead bodies of the police officers. Haynes performed this operation and testified in court about the chemical similarities of the two pieces of evidence. In fact, he noted that the chemical composition, the metallurgical composition of the bombs found in Ligg's apartment was unlike anything commercially available. It wasn't like any commercially available pipes, wasn't like any commercially available solder, wasn't like any commercially available lead. It had to have been some particular and unique alloy of a bunch of scrap that had been heated and poured into these molds uniquely. And then he testified that the shrapnel pulled from one of the police officer's body had a similar composition. This is probably the first chemical testimony ever introduced in a trial in American history. As it turns out, The bombshell, one of the bombshells found in Ling's apartment, allegedly found in Ling's apartment, still resides in the Chicago History Museum. And I found out that some of the pieces of the shrapnel pulled from some of the police officers' bodies were actually held in an archive at the Beneke Library at Yale. And so back in 2003, I organized an effort to reanalyze these samples and check Dr. Haynes' work to see if perhaps they match. So we got the bombshells. You can see here it's about the same size as a softball. Has a hole drilled through the middle for the bolt. And interestingly, you can see this little piece, this little chunk taken out here. This is actually the evidence of the scarring, because when Haynes did his original analysis, he had to tear some of the metal off so he could dissolve it in a beaker. And there you can actually see little indentations where he took his stylus and scraped out the middle. Here is a fragment of a shrapnel piece that killed Officer Michael Deegan the night of May 4th, 1886. This little piece probably severed his femoral artery and caused him to bleed out on the bricks of Desplein Street. It's still in the archive in Yale. It's a very small piece. You can see it's about 2 millimeters or 2 centimeters. And we put these pieces. I had nothing to do with this. I know nothing about science, so all my colleagues did this. Put it in a scanning electron microscope, because we're not allowed to actually do what Haynes did. He had the luxury of actually scraping the metal, dissolving it in beakers, and doing some very, what we call wet chemical analysis, which is much more accurate, but then you destroy the sample. We weren't allowed to do that. We had to do indirect methods with this scanning electron microscope. It reveals metal by having different peaks on the scanning graph here, and these correspond to different atomic weights of metal, and my chemical colleagues can then infer from that percentages of tin and zinc and iron and copper and lead and antimony, and they found that although the specifics differed somewhat, the margin of error was within what the original testing was done. So we confirmed that at least Dr. Haynes in 1886 presented an honest analysis of the samples he was given, and they did match. And the other thing we found is that they were unlike other types of commercially available lead. It was a unique alloy that someone had thrown some things together and melted. The most interesting thing we found is the existence of antimony in this metal. And I discovered that antimony was an alloy, was an element that they put into lead to make it harder, and was primarily used in printer's type. So most likely the bomb was actually made from melted printer's type, leftover printer's type. Okay, so I published all this a few years back, and the response was, I would say, pretty negative. I took heart in the words of one of my mentors in college, and that's that you really haven't made your mark till you've made some rivals. And one of the rejoinders in Labor a few years back, I got the wonderful compliment of being accused of having blood on my lips for even daring to say such a thing. So Messer Cruz should look and sniff rather carefully before partaking of the libation. We may end up with the sickly sweet repugnance of blood on our lips. Beautifully poetic. Yes.
So what is this Lardo? Is this a result type of wine
burger? Yes.
Are you going to tell us later on that it's also that there were other types of the resin as well?
Some others, yes. Right.
But I was just sort of wondering where you went down that gap of, is this one perfect?
No.
Okay.
So there's a very curious thing about this whole issue of Louis Ling and bomb making. The most curious thing is that if you read the trial transcript, his lawyers admitted that he was making bombs the very day of the Haymarket bombing. This was never a question in the trial. In fact, the physical and testimonial evidence against Louis Ling was so great that his own attorney admitted that he was doing this and tried to make an argument that he had a right to do it. In the opening of the defense case, so when the, you know, in the standard trial, the prosecution presents its evidence first, then the state rests, and then the defense gets this opportunity to present rebutting information. But before they actually call any witnesses, the defense has an opportunity to actually just simply present to the jury their theory of the case and their overall plan for the defense. It's a very important part of the trial when the lawyer comes up and says, we're going to tell you that it was actually this way and not that way. It sort of sets the whole tone for what the jury is going to hear. So in these opening statements for the defense, one of the attorneys for the Haymarket anarchists, Moses Salomon, said this about Ling. With the whereabouts of Ling, you are already familiar. It may seem strange why he was manufacturing bombs. The answer to that is he had a right to have his house full of dynamite. He had a right to have weapons of all descriptions upon his premises, and until he used them or advised their use, and they were used in pursuance of his advice, he is not liable any more than the man who commits numerous burglaries, the man who commits numerous thefts, who walks the streets, is liable to arrest and punishment only when he commits an act which can be discovered. That's the last part of that. I don't know if Louis Ling appreciated the fact that his own lawyer was comparing him to a thief and a burglar. But at that moment in the trial, it was indisputable, according to the evidence presented, that Ling was involved in making a bomb which was shown to have been chemically and physically similar to that which was thrown the night of the bombing. In fact, some of the witnesses who testified, anarchists who turned state's evidence and testified for the state, talked about how during the day of May 4th, in the hours before the protest, Ling was in a frenzy of assembling bombs. Indeed, there was about 6 men in his apartment who were all assisting in this effort. And it was very clear that they were rushing to get some job done before that evening. And his roommate and his fellow anarchist testified that once they were done with the bombs, they loaded them all up into a bag and took them to Neff's saloon, which at the time was known as the shanty of the communists. And they left the bag in a back room where and anybody could come and take a bomb. And that was testified to as well. So I think it's very difficult to separate Ling from the event. It's very, very difficult. And there are other interesting things that come about. August Spies, the editor of the Arbiter Zeitung, the daily newspaper in Chicago, was given the chance to testify in his own defense. He was only one of 2 of the 8 men who testified in their own defense. He was put on the stand. And this, I think, looking back, and I argue in my book, was a very, very unfortunate tactical error for the defense to put August Spies on the stand. And I'm sure they chose to do so because he was a very charismatic, charming, polished man. He was very learned, very accomplished. By all accounts, just the most winning personality you could ever imagine. And I think they wanted to have him on the stand to make a good impression with the jury. But once he was on the stand, of course, there were a lot of areas of questioning which probably weren't to the benefit of the defense. At one point, the prosecution, on its cross-examination, confronted Spies with the fact that police had found a package of dynamite and fuses in his editorial office. Now, had Spies not testified, the defense could have said, well, those were planted by the police. We know nothing about them. But Spies was put on the stand, and he was asked, why did you get that dynamite? And he answered, I got that dynamite to experiment with in the first place. That was my intention. Did you ever experiment with it? I did not. Why did you want to experiment with it? Oh, I thought What object did you have in experimenting with the dynamite? I had read a good deal about dynamite. I thought it would be a good thing to get acquainted with the use of it. Why would it be a good thing to get acquainted with the use of it? Well, for general reasons. Could you not get acquainted with it enough for your purposes by reading? Answer, I wanted to experiment with dynamite just the same as I would take a revolver and go out and practice with a revolver. Was that the only reason you had? Yes, sir. You just merely from curiosity. No, I can't say it was merely curiosity. I don't want to say that exactly. Then what was it, if not merely curiosity? I think I have explained sufficiently. Can you give any further explanation than you have given? No, I don't see as I could. This could not have played very well with the jury. In fact, the defense never disputed the fact that the article seized from the editorial office of August Spies, which he shared, by the way, with Albert Parsons, were in fact found there. A package of dynamite, coil of fuse, and a number of incriminating letters were found in his desk, including one letter which he received from a fellow anarchist leader in New York, which clearly alluded to the shipping of dynamite from New York to Chicago. Did you get the package? Yes, I got the package. Did the medicine arrive? Yes, the medicine arrived. That sort of thing. Okay, so when you read through the trial transcript, there are clearly connections. There's clearly, quote unquote, evidence connecting some of the eight men on trial to what happened that night. It's still an open question whether that amounts to what the state alleged, and that's a general conspiracy to kill police that night. It's still an open question. The state, however, once they had the connection of Louis Ling and August Spies, once they were able to connect two of the men to the actual throwing of the bomb or the making of the bomb, then they had a lower burden of what they had to do with the rest of the prosecution. All they had to do for the rest of the prosecution was then link all the eight men together. They didn't have to show that all eight were as materially liable. They just had to show that all eight had foreknowledge of what the other two were doing by the legal standards of the day. And the way that this was largely done was with this famous Monday night meeting, the meeting at which the Haymarket bombing was supposedly discussed and agreed upon. It was held in the basement of a saloon, Greaves Hall. The upper floors were used for the meetings of unions. The basement was an unfinished place with planks on barrels and an old sputtering kerosene lamp. And the men of the Lehr und Wehrverein met there on Monday night, May 3rd, the night before the Haymarket, and supposedly there set in motion their conspiracy to do violence at Haymarket. Now, this is discussed in Average's book. Indeed, this is discussed in every account of Haymarket. But the Monday night conspiracy meeting, as it's so called, is often dismissed and discounted because it is said that nothing was said about doing any violence at the Haymarket meeting, at that meeting. In fact, if you read Haverich's book on page 273, he says, as both Waller and Schrade admitted, those were both people who had testified for the state, nothing was said at the Greaves Hall meeting about any action to be taken at the Haymarket, unquote. But when you read through the trial testimony, the actual account of what was said in open court, here is the questioning of Bernard Schrade, one of the state's witnesses that was alluded to in that quote. Schrade said of what happened at the meeting, he said, he stated the objects of the meeting. Here he's talking about Engel, who chaired the meeting, who was one of the Haymarket defendants. He stated the objects of the meeting. He said an explanation that so many men at the McCormick factory had been shot dead by the police. He said that a mass meeting was to be held at Haymarket Square and that they were to come prepared to, and then his own lawyer says, well, and he says that they were to come prepared in case the police should meddle with the meeting, interfere with the meeting. So there clearly was a connection between the planned Haymarket and being prepared to respond if the police interfere. Yes, there was. And they had an overall plan, and this is the really intriguing part of this whole story that I think is most important. The plan was not just to evoke, not just to wreak havoc or revenge on the police that might interfere with their lawful meeting. They had an overall systematic plan of how you would take over the city of Chicago and try and replicate something like the Paris Commune in Chicago. So the Leer und Wehrverein, which were the armed paramilitary of the radical movement, were each to station themselves in various outlying parks of the city. And upon the upon a certain signal, which they were to receive, they were then to begin attacking the outlying police stations. This would draw the police away from the inner part of the city towards the outer part of the city, and hopefully then allow the workers who had gathered in the central part of the city, where Haymarket was, to prevail in whatever riot might occur. So they talked about how they had to have riflemen stationed outside the police. And when the police get the call to come to the riot downtown, they can shoot them as they come out of their stations. They should have bombs and riflemen ready to attack them when they leave their stations, because that's when they're most vulnerable. And they talked about how what happens if the firemen intervene, because in those days, firemen sort of acted as an adjunct to the police. Well, in that case, we have to shoot them down too and cut their hoses. They had a plan for cutting the telegraph wires so that there couldn't be communication among the various stations. The important point is that when you move from simply trying to exonerate the anarchists to looking at what was their worldview, what was their plan, what was their idea, you begin to see that they had a more revolutionary, transformative plan of that weekend, and that there were these almost millennial hopes that this was the moment at which the working class might actually rise as one, and that their historic role was to be the armed vanguard of that class, and to make the most of this one opportunity, perhaps the only opportunity they would have their entire lives, to actually create a revolutionary social change. And that's what begins to come into view when you begin to move past this, the long-standing and I would argue less accurate interpretations of what went on that weekend.
Just a quick question on the previous slide. In the responses provided to the question, the label is the interpreter.
Right.
And so Mr. Schrott did not speak English, another native language.
Correct.
And has there ever been any questioning about the role of the interpreter in this process? I mean, basically, is there concurrence that what the interpreter, with the information that the interpreter provided, was in fact what Mr. Schrott said?
Yes, and that happened at the trial, because when the interpreter would give an interpretation, the defense was given the opportunity to either accept that interpretation or to challenge it. And since Moses Salomon and Ziesler were both native German speakers and lawyers of the defense, they often would quickly jump in to challenge a certain use of a word. And you see that throughout the transcript, and that would always be noted in the transcript. So if there was any challenging of the interpretation, it would have been noted. In this case, it was not challenged. This is what the sense of what he would have said. My work is really not. My purpose is not to say that the Haymarket martyrs were all guilty in the sense that we normally think of guilt. My purpose is to allow us to see them in a broader ideological history, that when we simply focus upon their guilt or innocence, we can't really get to the question of what did they really believe? What part of an intellectual movement were they a part of? And I think when we allow ourselves to see them as revolutionaries and not just as victims, we can begin to understand what it was they hoped to achieve and how they hoped to achieve it. There are many dramatic instances in the trial where this hidden ideology, this apocalyptic revolutionary ideology that they shared comes into view. One of my favorites is when, this would be before the formal trial, when the grand jury was still meeting to have indictments. They were calling witnesses to the grand jury. And one of the witnesses they called was a very, very fervent and militant anarchist in the Chicago movement. His name was Gerhard Lysias. And Lysias he was one of the authors of some of the most inflammatory articles in the anarchist press of the time. One of his most famous articles was headlined, "Dynamite, Oh, All the Good Stuff." So he was really on the edge of things. And at the time he was called to the grand jury, Lysias was in the last stages of dying of tuberculosis. He could barely walk to the grand jury room. He knew he was on his last legs, which I think gave him a certain autonomy of thought. And so when he got in front of the grand jury, he refused to answer their questions. Instead, he used this as an opportunity to scold them. And this is one of the things that he said. "You do not," and you can just imagine this man coughing and sick and sickly and sitting in front of this room, and you can just imagine his passion. "You do not and will not understand the excuse for the Haymarket slaughter. You measure your grievance by what you know. Were you to give the theory of socialism an impartial investigation, you would then understand that the achievement of its purposes and the enjoyment of its benefits warrant 1,000 times as much bloodshed as you now seek to revenge yourselves for." Wow. He's not interested in pleading innocence here at all. He's interested in standing up and being defiant before this face of power. He's interested in saying, "This is exactly what we had to do. We did what we had to do. My only regret is that we didn't accomplish our purposes." Now, the other person who you see this idea peeking through the clouds a little bit is again with Louis Ling, who I would argue was the most committed and militant of the eight men tried. Committed and militant in terms of his ideology of the need for violent action and the need for immediate revolution. That was really the core of this subculture of the left that existed at that time. Ling, by the way, he's a very mysterious person because in his very brief life, he did a lot of different things, many of them not well documented. It's known that he spent about a year and a half in the various cantons of Switzerland, probably running with the great German anarchist August Reinsdorf, who was eventually executed for attempting to blow up the entire imperial train with the Kaiser on board. It's not well documented. There's some very small citations that this may have been true. I have not had the opportunity to go to the cantons of Switzerland and try and track this down. If any of you ever want to, by all means, I'd love to read about it. But he's a very mysterious person. He certainly has a very deep history with the actual German anarchist movement. Ling didn't say a word throughout his entire trial. He was not called to testify. He didn't speak with the press. He held his own counsel. But after he was sentenced, he was given the opportunity to address the court. And he didn't make a long speech, but here's his peroration. This is how he ends his speech. "Anarchy is called disorder, anarchy in opposition against the order of things, which does not allow a man to live a life that is worth living. I declare here once more openly with all my powers, with all my mind, I must combat such disorder. Even if this praiseworthy object should be defeated with cannon, I shall use dynamite. You smile. You perhaps think I will not use bombs anymore. Anymore. But I tell you, I die gladly upon the gallows in the sure hope that hundreds and thousands of people to whom I have spoken will now recognize and make use of dynamite. In this hope, I despise you and despise your laws. Hang me for it." Those were his last words to the court. And his last act of resistance was making sure they didn't get the pleasure of actually hanging him for it. He took his own life. So what I end up with is, I think, when we move beyond issues of victimization, martyrhood, guilt, and innocence, and we simply ask the question, assuming that these eight individuals belonged to a revolutionary movement, assuming that they actually believed in the words that they said, what was it that they actually believed? What did they hope to accomplish? And what comes into view is a very unique moment of cultural and ideological history of the American left. That there was a moment in the mid-1880s, in the chaos of urban America, when a small group of very committed radicals truly committed themselves to revolutionary change. And that revolutionary change, they understood, had to be violent, to be effective, and they were willing to take that chance. And though their plans went horribly awry, none of the groups that supposedly met outside the city to attack police stations actually had the guts to do it. They simply melted off into the night. Only one man threw a bomb at Haymarket. They hoped that there would be dozens. They hoped that they would scatter the police. That didn't happen. The police instead held their ground, rallied, fought back, and scattered the anarchists. They hoped this would be the beginning of a Paris Commune in Chicago. Instead, it was the beginning of a reign of terror that destroyed their movement. But that does not necessarily compromise what they believed. The fact that it didn't work doesn't mean they didn't believe it. And I guess my purpose in revisiting this story is to try and recover that lost, failed revolutionary moment that I think, and I think the documents show, did exist. So that's it. I'm open to questions. Comes directly from the book by Dyer Lum, the very first account of the Haymarket riot and trial that was published in 1887. It was published while the seven men were still on death row. It was published as an effort to rally support for their, at least their commutation of sentences, hopefully for some kind of a pardon. Dyer Lum was an anarchist himself who took over from Albert Parsons, the editorship of The Alarm, once Parsons went to prison. So it was clearly not a scholarly book or one that had any pretense of neutrality. It was a campaign book, if you will. But that campaign book by Dyer Lum eventually became one of the core references for scholars later on who would write about this event. He, in many ways, Lum set the pattern and the template for how scholars would write about Haymarket for 100 years to come. And it was Lum who in that book asserted that this was probably the work of either a Pinkerton or the police themselves. Of course, there's absolutely no evidence anywhere. There's not a scrap of testimony in the trial. There's not a scrap of any evidence in the newspaper record. There's not a scrap of any evidence in any memoirs of the anarchists involved. In fact, all the later statements that we have of the surviving anarchists, and most important would be Oscar Niebe, who would be the last of the eight to die. He lived in to a pretty old age, living in Chicago his whole time. And Henry David recounts this in his book, that he interviewed Oscar Niebe before he died. Actually, he didn't interview Oscar Niebe. He interviewed Oscar Niebe's neighbor and his best friend. And his best friend said that Oscar Niebe told him repeatedly that, in fact, it was an anarchist who threw the bomb. and that the police story was spurious, and that the best account of the whole thing, he said, maybe supposedly said, was by the inspector, the police inspector, Michael Schack. But there is no evidence. There's a claim, but there's nothing behind it. Well, there is that, and this is something that I'm also very interested in, is that up until the point at which the eight men are clearly going to go on trial for their lives, the movement was not shy about stating what its real purposes was. In all their publications, in all their speeches, it was very clearly, we are a revolutionary movement, we stand for immediate revolutionary change, and we believe that change can only come about through direct action and violence. That's what they said consistently for years. The minute the eight men were on trial for their lives, that line had to change, because clearly that was not going to contribute to their exoneration. And suddenly, these eight men morphed into trade union, eight-hour day, reformist liberals. And the whole revolutionary aspect to their ideology is suddenly forgotten. And I think this was a necessity of the moment. I mean, clearly when men are on trial for their lives, they need to do what they can to escape the noose. But because this became crystallized in Dyer Lum's campaign book for them, it became something of a established text, and it became very hard to vary that line and to really look at what they had said and believed before that time. In fact, the standard line about how to explain all those revolutionary things they were saying up until June of 1886 when they went on trial, well, they were just trying to get attention. Those weren't sincere statements. Those were attention-getting statements, because whenever you'd cry bombs, a reporter would come running and you could get a nice audience. Well, that's one interpretation.
If I understand correctly, the original demonstration was something that people were shot, was part of the movement of the other day, and I was wondering how this whole process fit into the rest of the labor.
That's an excellent, excellent question. And this is another very revealing and just fascinating side of the story, the anarchist relationship to the eight-hour day movement. When the eight-hour day was announced by the predecessor to the AFL, the anarchists denounced it, and denounced it frequently and often and passionately. They thought the eight-hour day was a diversion for workers. They thought it was impossible to achieve. They thought it was something that would misdirect the efforts of a radical working class. And they believed that they were on the cusp of revolutionary change. And they wanted to combat anything that would give workers false hopes. Because they believed you had to have a militant working class focused on revolutionary change. And this eight-hour idea, the pie in the sky eight-hour idea, it's suddenly going to bring libraries and recreation and playgrounds and increased wages and everything else you want, would just make it more difficult to actually achieve real change. So they opposed that movement. Even Albert Parsons, who in his earlier life as a labor leader had been one of the national leaders of the eight-hour day movement, began publishing articles in The Alarm criticizing the eight-hour movement as impossible, unrealistic, unrevolutionary. And this went on for over a year with the anarchists criticizing the eight-hour movement. And they finally began embracing it, at least in public, about the winter of 1885-1886. And what pushed them to do so was that the trade unions in Chicago were being very successful in recruiting new members on the basis of the eight-hour movement. Their ranks were swelling rapidly, and the leaders of that trade union movement, who the anarchists hated, were suddenly receiving a new stature as a result of that 8-hour movement. So in that winter time, they made a calculated decision to publicly endorse the 8-hour movement and to try and get out in front of it. But here's the interesting thing. Throughout the spring of 1886, leading up until the May Day weekend, the anarchist line was, we can't just demand the 8-hour day. We have to demand the 8-hour day and a raise. And we have to do this without compromise. Well, what this amounts to on the ground for an actual union, for someone who's actually trying to organize workers, is that you'd organize workers to demand an 8-hour day. The boss might say, okay, I grant you the 8-hour day. And then they would come back and say, but we want a pay raise of 20%. And they would push the issue to the point where it led to conflict. And this was the radicals' tactic. They wanted to amp up the conflict wherever possible to illustrate to the workers the irreconcilability between the working class and the owning class. They didn't want any compromise. And all the anarchist leaders and all the anarchist unions through that spring of 1886 refused compromise. And whenever, in fact, the bosses did agree to their demands, they came back with another demand that would not be met for the purpose of having conflict. The best example is at a factory called Brunswick, which made parlor furniture. And it had been organized by the German woodworkers who were allied with the anarchists. And they initially demanded the 8-hour day. And the Brunswick company accepted that. And they said, that's not good enough. We want the 8-hour day and 10 hours pay. And the company waited about a week, and it said, okay, we agree. We'll do it. And then they came back and they said, we want that factory that you own in Cincinnati to close down and production to move to Chicago immediately. That was the next demand. And the ownership said, you gotta be out of your minds. We're not gonna close down a factory and throw those workers out of work and give you the work. It's not gonna happen. And so then they had their irreconcilable conflict, and from there they went on. In fact, from what I can find in my research, there wasn't a single instance throughout the entire spring of 1886 where an anarchist union came to terms with their bosses, ever. And I think this was clearly the tactic. This was the way of trying to get ahead of the 8-hour movement, turn it to revolutionary purposes, and harness it. And the same was true of the McCormick riot on May 3rd. The demonstration that led to the McCormick riot on May 3rd was not a demonstration of McCormick workers at all. It was a demonstration of lumber workers, which was organized by a lumber workers union which had no affiliation with the anarchists. They had called a meeting in the open air prairie for 3 o'clock to hear their negotiating committee report back on what they had learned from their bosses. The anarchists, in what is a time-worn, proven tactic, showed up at 2. Not at 3, they showed up at 2. And they took control of the stage. And as the crowds gathered, they threw the lumber worker leader off the boxcar they were talking from and controlled the crowd. And when the bell tolled at the McCormick factory, which was about a quarter mile away across the prairie, one of the leaders, we don't know who, stepped up on the boxcar and said, "Go get the scabs!" And at that point, many people ran across the prairie to attack the workers who were leaving the McCormick factory at 5 o'clock. Those people weren't scabs, by the way. Those were just McCormick workers, because McCormick had settled his strike earlier that day. He had agreed to the 8-hour day that morning. And those were workers who had worked at McCormick for a long time and had just won their 8-hour day. And when they were leaving work that day, they were confronted by this mass of workers who were whipped up into a frenzy. And they were stoned and beaten and driven back into the factory, and that provoked the police then to intervene violently. It's pretty clear there was gunfire on both sides. In fact, August Spies, who ran back to his newspaper office to report on that incident, reported in the Arbeiter Zeitung, there was gunfire on both sides, basically, he said, but our guns were smaller than their guns, and so we lost.
What's your assessment of the quality of the tenant?
Couldn't have been worse. In fact, today it would have been grounds for immediate retrial on the basis of incompetence, ineffective counsel. At every point, every major decision point that I could identify in the trial that could have had a material difference on the outcome, the defense chose not only the wrong tactic, but probably a disastrous tactic, and their choices seem to have been driven consistently by the desire to maintain a public stage as opposed to actually getting their clients off. One of the most striking of these examples was a very important motion, because if you're going to try eight men jointly and the eight have various different levels of culpability, you're going to be basically contributing to the prosecution of some of the men that shouldn't be. I mean, when you have Ling, who is going to be bombarded with physical and testimonial evidence that he made bombs, and then you have someone like Oscar Niebe, who his only crime was distributing the flyers for the Haymarket protest. That's the only physical act that was ever proven against him. He distributed the flyers. That was his part in that. And you're going to try those two men together? There was an opportunity to actually petition for a severance of the trial into two trials. In fact, theoretically, you could petition to sever it into eight trials. But they were going to petition to sever it into two trials. And when the defense attorney presented this motion to the judge looked at it and in an offhand way said, "Is this a serious motion?" And the defense attorney said, "Well, really, Your Honor, it's not."
Let me follow up on both Michelle's question and one prior. I guess all of us know that the history of labor we've had, the Molly Maguire trial, the McNamara Brothers trial, the Joe Hill trial.
Mooney,
Tom Mooney, you've got the...
Sacco Vanzetti, yeah.
Sacco Vanzetti. I mean, the problem is that in some cases, even, the question of Sacco Vanzetti was maybe one innocent, the other one guilty.
Right.
The McNamara Brothers were guilty.
Right.
Even after being a cause celeste. I mean, I've read the transcript of the Molly Maguire case.
Right.
Definitely something maybe was going on, but most of these people were innocent. I mean, it's uneven.
Right.
Lenny Bruce once said, halt of justice, the only justice is at the halt.
Right.
So in that way, it's interesting from the point of view that what you're really laying out is that these guys, in some cases, very well may be guilty. Now, then you have to go back and you're trying to talk about context. I guess I'm fascinated by the notion that if you say that we're doing a two-year countdown and on May 1st, something big is going to happen, and that was basically what the labor movement said.
Mm-hmm.
You're automatically playing into the possibility that an anarchist movement is going to say, we've got a countdown in America to an actual
revolution. That's what they believed. Yeah.
That would be the argument that I'm asking. In effect, are you saying that the countdown was, in effect, part of it, given the fact that had been established?
Absolutely. Yes.
And just to take us back to the predecessor to this is the 1877 railroad run.
Right. Right.
Up till that time, it's all local expression and everything else. So another argument you could make is that basically it is a revolutionary moment, probably from 1877 to 1886.
That's right.
And you see that then continuing?
No, it stops in its tracks, at least in America. I mean, a similar ideology reappears again later on with some of the Italian anarchist immigration. Fundamentally, this stream of revolutionary ideology, which comes directly from Bakunin and the Russian nihilists, and interesting connections with the German anarchist movement, which was exiled, of course, by Bismarck's anti-socialist laws. This very unique and heady and passionate movement was completely destroyed by the Haymarket episode. just uprooted, you know, root to branch. And I think, and I haven't written about this, but my belief is that one of the reasons it was so thoroughly uprooted is that it became necessary, and then it became customary to deny that it ever existed among those who were once adherents to it. That's probably the most effective way of suppressing a movement, is to get the movement's participants to deny it ever existed.
Well, let us thank him one more time.
Thank you.